Hello, everyone. Welcome to Life Combos with Tyriana. I'm your host, Tyriana Evans, and I'm really excited for today's podcast episode. I have someone who is very close to me and dear to me joining me on this podcast. So you might remember a few months ago, I had my mom on to talk about my life as a homeschooler, and I highly recommend listening to that episode if you have not had a chance already. But today's episode, I get to have one of my siblings on the podcast. So my younger sister, Tyla, is joining the podcast today, and we're going to be talking about her journey to law school because she is going to be starting law school in the fall. And then also just a little bit about how she got involved with politics because it is very unique. I don't think many young people are involved with politics, but my little sister is, we always have joked that she is a mini politician. So she's definitely a mini politician. And, you know, maybe one day we'll become an actual politician. I wouldn't put that past her, but welcome to the podcast, Tyla.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, you know, the podcast doesn't know who you are and stuff. So I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself a little bit, talk a little bit about your background in terms of like what college you graduated from.
Yeah, so I know you because we grew up together. So most of the fun facts about, I don't know how much you've told the pod, but born and raised Prince George's County, Maryland. I went to the George Washington University for undergrad via you in your commencement. I don't know if you've talked about that either, but I was so inspired by your speech and by your graduation at GW that in 2019 I was like, you know what? This is a really neat school. It worked for my life trajectory, wanting to be a political scientist. So I went to GW, graduated in 2023. And then this upcoming fall, I'll be going to Temple Law. And in the meantime, in between time, I've done several internships. When I was in undergrad, I interned for the personal office of President Barack and Mrs. Michelle Obama. I've done Senate internships and House internships, and ultimately, when I graduated from college, I ended up working on the House side, at the U.S. House of Representatives for a bit, and then went over to the Biden-Harris administration, where I worked at the U.S. Treasury Department as a political appointee. And so it's been a journey, and it still continues each day, but that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, and you know, Tyler forgot to mention, but she actually graduated from high school at 16, and she actually ended up transferring to GW just like me. She originally started off at community college just because she was so young and, you know, needed to just be a little bit closer to home and figure out exactly what she wanted to do. And then once she did a couple of classes there, you know, excelled in them, did great. She ended up transferring to GW. And I don't know, did you ever live in the same dorm as me? Did you ever live in District House?
I did. I was in the Women of Color affinity for a full year.
Are you serious?
That was
I didn't know that.
my first year on campus. So during the pandemic, I was supposed to what's that one that's isn't it? It's named after a first lady. It's a Jacqueline
Hey,
Atlanta.
Jacqueline Kennedy or something.
So I was supposed to live in JBKO, I think is the official name. I was supposed to live there during the pandemic, but we didn't end up being on campus, so I never lived in that dorm. So circa 2021, I lived in District House for a full year in the Women of Color affinity. It was an experience that I'll have to detail one day in a book. And then after that, I was at, what's the dorm across the street from South? The Dakota.
Yeah.
I lived in the Dakota.
I do remember the Dakota, but I don't remember District House. That's so crazy. Was I in Syracuse, maybe?
Probably. I mean, that was my first dorm, but I don't think you were there when I moved in, so.
Yeah, I think I was at Syracuse when you were starting. You started in 2021?
Well, it started in 2020. I moved for the first time in 2021 because of
Yeah.
the pandemic.
I think I was at Syracuse.
All
Right, well. So, Talo, what made you want to study political science? For the listeners who might not know this, GW, or also known as George Washington University, I would say one of the most popular majors is political science just because we're located in the heart of DC, steps from the White House. So, everybody wants to study politics, eventually work for, you know, a campaign. But what made you decide, this is something I want to do?
Yeah, so when I was really, really young, I had two interests in life. And I still really only have two interests in life. So I like consistency. One thing about me, I'm very consistent. But I had two main interests. That was sports. And that was social activism. And so originally, I was like, you know what, that seems like a really hard lifestyle to do politics. And you see kind of, you know, if you've ever paid attention to someone who has spent their career as a politician, they start off looking really good. And then over the years, you start to pull up some pictures and do some side by sides. And you're like, oh, Lord, you know, politics can take you out, age you. It is wear and tear, emotionally, physically, all the things. And so as a very young child, I was like, ugh, I want to look good when I grow up. And I don't want to be tired by the time I'm like 45. And so I was like, I'm going to stick with sports. And originally, actually, I wanted to do sports journalism. One of my favorite things to do as a young child is I would literally sit in front of the TV in the summertime and I would turn on SportsCenter and I would probably just leave it on all day. And everything, I would watch every segment about every sport, whether they were talking about the NBA draft or the NFL mini camps that were coming up, OTAs, or if it was the PGA golf tournament on. Or if it was tennis on in the summertime, I mean, it was just like never ending fun experience for me to just sit in front of the TV and just hear about the world of sports all day long. And so I remember being young and being like, that's what I want to do. And then I kind of switched and I was like, well, maybe I want to be a sideline reporter. Maybe I want to do that. And then finally, by the time I got to high school, I had really just I realized that there's a difference in life between passion and purpose. And I was always very passionate about sports. Very, very passionate. I still am to this day. But it didn't feel purposeful. It felt like that was a hobby of mine, something that maybe I enjoyed, but maybe not something that I was supposed to dedicate my entire life to. And so I ended up really taking some time, probably between like my sophomore and junior years of high school. And I was like, what feels purposeful? What is something that I enjoy doing that gets me up in the morning, that invigorates my soul? And it was probably around this time, if my years are kind of aligning correctly, where it's right in the midst of this whole racial reckoning, as people like to call it. And so, you know, this is circa Trayvon Martin. This is circa Philando Castile, and having to turn on the TV every single day, whether you were on a news channel or anything, and you hear about, you know, some black boy or black man or a black woman had just been shot by police. And I remember like a core memory of end of middle school, beginning of high school was just having to see these videos on replay, every single day, especially when it was fresh news or when, it was time for, you know, the court case to come up. They would start to replay the videos over and over and over again. And so I have vivid memories of like the first time I saw the Philando Castile video. I literally remember that day, the first time it played and the first time I saw it. And I remember my mom's response to the Trayvon Martin verdict. And it was in kind of that time where I started to become conscious of what it means to be Black in America. And I think that sometimes it's easy to be disconnected because we were homeschooled. We did grow up in a very safe area. We grew up in the suburbs. We were, you know, into sports young, you all doing swimming, me doing gymnastics. And so it's easy to grow up and not really be conscious of what it means to be an African-American in a country that was built on destabilizing your culture, your community. And so it was around that time where I was like, okay, this is what invigorates me. This is what inspires me. It's the process of accountability in holding this country, holding our leaders accountable for what America is today, and understanding that progress is always forward. It's never backwards. And so if I could be a part of dedicating my life and my career to moving this country forward in a day and time where people would rather move us backwards, then I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. That's what I want to spend my life doing. And so that took me all the way to GW. And by the time I got to GW, I had actually already worked in politics. When I was 17 years old, I won a scholarship from a Maryland delegate. And at the award ceremony, I had talked to the chief of staff, and I was like, hey, would love to come help and volunteer around the office. The long story short of all this is I ended up being hired. Don't know how, because I don't ever remember interviewing for this position.
Yes, you didn't even drive yourself yet. Like, I remember I was driving you to different like political events that were happening for the person that you worked for.
Yeah, so I think the story that always sticks out to me is, and I'll get back to the part about you driving me, it's kind of two things from this time where I was a legislative aide at the Maryland General Assembly. Is when I came in to volunteer for the first time, my mom had driven me. And it turns out that that wasn't so much a volunteer opportunity. It was actually a job interview. And so I'm sitting with the chief of staff interviewing, and my mom is like sitting in the back, probably like couponing or something like that, or like reading a newspaper. And I remember walking out of that interview after they had literally basically offered me the job on the spot. And I remember turning to my mom and being like, I'm never going to forget that my first ever job interview, you were just sitting in the back, just like pretending to not eavesdrop or anything. I just thought that was so hilarious and so funny. But yeah, so once I got that job, I had worked in politics. That was fresh out of high school. So that was like my first year at Anne Arundel Community College. And I was thrown into the fire immediately. So one of my jobs was to be a community liaison in addition to the role of being a legislative aide. And I will never forget going to community meetings, sitting with the, you know, sheriff of Prince George's County, sitting with county council members. And then I was the representative from the delegate's office, sitting with these grown adults. And I'm all of literally 17 years old. And they're asking me about issues happening in the community. And the other thing that was really difficult is I was working in a district that I didn't live. And it was also on the other side of the county. So I really didn't get out there much. I didn't have any context for the things they went through, what they were experiencing. I knew where I was from and the cities that were local to me. I had no idea what was going on there. And so it was such a funny experience, I think, in hindsight. And while it was happening, literally my first day after leaving work, I came home and I literally sat on my couch and I cried because I was like, A, this has got to be the worst joke ever played on me by God, because why in the world am I 17 and a legislative aide and this is too much and doing this in school? And on top of that, I'm just a girl. Like, how am I supposed to help these people experiencing, you know, food deserts and their rent is too high?
Food insecurity.
Yeah, exactly. And the rent is too high, and you know, they're worried about not having traffic lights and all these things. And I was just like, really? I don't even have a driver's license. I don't know anything about any of this stuff. But one of the main takeaways I learned in that experience was the importance of having compassion, and that you can learn to be empathetic for someone going through something that maybe you have never experienced. And that was so important when I got to GW, because GW is a school where the median income is something that you would probably not believe. These are very rich, very wealthy kids, and they were all, you know, rah, 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 fight for change and, you know, expand the Supreme Court and all the progressive ideals that are right. in practice, but they had no empathy for people going through things that they had never even seen or experienced. They didn't understand DC. They didn't understand the DMV. They didn't understand that they were going to school with kids who had never even come in contact with the amount of money that their parents had. So that's ultimately, all of those experiences led me to GW, led me to major in political science. And like I said, by the time I got to GW, it was already affirmed within my actual experiences, but then also just within my heart that I had found something that was purposeful to me.
Yeah, thank you for that summary. I don't know, while you were talking, I was just thinking about how even our mom, I don't think I talked about this on the episode with her, but she tried to be as politically involved as possible. Like, she definitely always would take us to voting with her. She wanted us to see what it meant to make sure to know that your vote counted and that your vote mattered. And there were times, I remember, we were very little, standing in line, like for presidential elections and probably even for President Obama, and how the lines were incredibly long. But it was important for her to make sure that we were with her to say, hey, like, you don't get out of line. You don't complain. Like, you just stand here and know that there were people, ancestors, that died for you to have this right to vote. I think also we saw her kind of protest. But there was definitely a time where the Prince George's County was considering, and, you know, now it's obviously here, but they were considering building a casino in the county. And my mom had done a little bit of research to see what happens when a casino comes to a neighborhood. And she saw that, you know, kids were less likely to meet like the reading requirements of their grade levels, and poverty was increased because people were gambling. So all of these things motivated her to go to like a town hall meeting and bring us along with her. And I think we were probably one of a few kids. I think she might have convinced some other homeschool moms to bring their kids with them too. But I remember someone had even asked her, why are you here with your kids? Like, they said, your kids should be in school. And she goes, I homeschool them. So they're going to come here and they're going to see what could happen if they speak out against something and to speak up about what is important to our values, especially not only for herself, but for the community. And so I think we were raised in an environment where our mom definitely tried to just emphasize the importance of politics. I think Tyla has obviously taken it a step further in just her roles, but it's always been something that is in, you know, the foundation of our family and is in everything that we do. It's important to us. I remember we have dinners and, you know, things, we're talking about what's happening across the world and current events. But, you know, we'll talk about this later. We not only focus on national news, but it's important about what's happening in our local community. And we'll talk about why it's important to get involved in local politics. But I did want to say, I remember when Tyla was getting ready to go to GW and she asked me, hey, did you ever do anything with College Dems, which is the official college organization for the Democratic Party? And I told her, honestly, I didn't really feel comfortable as a Black woman on a predominantly white campus. I didn't really feel comfortable joining that organization. And she said, okay. And then next thing I know, you can tell the podcast, but she is not only involved, but she's also serving in a leadership position. So I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, so I think that's a common theme in my personality, is that when somebody tells me they didn't feel welcome, or that they were in a space that didn't highlight, you know, their background and who they are. I remember when you told me that, and I kind of sat on it for a few minutes, maybe a few days. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. I think if the Democratic Party's values are true and these student organizations are under the guise of we are college Democrats, then that means that you should be a space that's welcoming to all people of all different backgrounds, no matter how you look, no matter your faith, no matter if you are the most progressive Democrat or the most conservative Democrat. It doesn't matter which side of the scale you're on. It's supposed to be a place where everyone feels welcome. And so I remember you, one of the things you had mentioned is that you were like, there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in the organization. And so one of the things that I inferred is that maybe it's not that it wasn't a place that was welcoming to you. Maybe there was just no one there to welcome you, because once again, it was a difference in having that context for what it means to be a Black woman in higher education, who's interested in politics, who cares about her community, who cares about her country. And so I took that and I ran with it and I said, well, that's a problem. If my sister, who was once a student, didn't feel comfortable, then we need to fix this. And we need to fix this right now. And so my first year at GW, I ended up joining College Democrats and I joined their deputy director board. And I ended up being the deputy director of the policy committee. Which again, wasn't really my forte. I was more social justice and activism. And so policy was a new thing for me. My final year, if we fast forward a little bit, I was the vice president of the organization. And so it was kind of funny because it was an organization.
You were vice president of one of the largest and most active college Dems organizations in the country. GW is a very politically involved campus and university. So we have the title of having the most active and involved. I mean, it's hundreds of students that are involved. It's one of the largest student organizations. And Tyla had worked her way up to being the vice president.
Yeah, and I think it's a testament to the fact that there is always room for you, although you may have to make that room, you may have to carve it out. There's always room for you. And so when it came to Dems, it was kind of a good old boys club. You know, it was groups of people who knew each other and who were friends. And once again, Deanna Presley has a quote and it says, "The people closest to the pain should be closest to the power." And it reigns true in almost every area I've seen, from being in College Democrats to working in the administration, is that that is oftentimes not the truth. So once again, it was kids that cared a lot, cared deeply, and were valid in, you know, how they felt in their cares for this country and their concerns as well. But once again, very, very few Black students were involved. Very few Black students wanted to be involved, because they did not feel wanted. And so I kind of came in, we diversified the club a little bit. And it was truly just one of the highlights of my college experience. I gained so many friends from that organization, got to meet incredible politicians, from Clyburn to Jeff Jackson, sit down and just kind of talk with incredible human beings. And that was also one of the main reasons why I was offered, you know, the internship with the Obamas. And so I owe a lot to GW Dems. And my only hope is that I can come back, you know, to maybe chat with the organization in 10 years. And I hope that it is way more diverse than when I was there. So it was a good experience.
Yeah, I hope the organization continues to evolve and hopefully will look more like America, because America is very diverse. So we're going to transition now. We've talked a lot about your undergrad experience and even before that, just how you got involved in politics. But now let's fast forward. As I mentioned, in the fall, you were going to be starting law school. What was that process like of applying to law school, taking the LSAT? Kind of just walk us through that.
My journey to law school was quite the complex situation. So along with me kind of deciding back in high school that I wanted to, you know, be in political science and work in politics, one of the things you start to realize really quick is that in order to make the largest impact within the realm of political science, it pays a lot of money to have a law degree. And so even, you know, when I was in middle school, high school, I honestly probably spent more time dreaming about the law school I would end up at than the undergraduate institution I would end up at. I wasn't so much concerned about where I would get my bachelor's as I was where I would get my JD. And so I applied to law school coming out of undergrad. And one of the things that I can now say as I reflect back on my experience is I want to shout out everybody who's trying to get somewhere that they had no one else in front of them to do it before them. And so I don't care if this is law school, I don't care if this is med school, I don't care if this is nursing school, I don't care if it's undergrad. It takes so much effort to be first generation anything at all. And so in our immediate family, we have no lawyers. And so when I conceived this idea in my mind that I wanted to be a lawyer, there was no blueprint in front of me at all. I had to figure this out from point A to point B. And my family is obviously, including you, Tariana, like extremely, extremely supportive. But it's one thing to, you know, cheer someone on, and it's another thing to give someone really sound advice about how to go about this and how to do this and the steps it takes. And so while you all were extremely supportive, I had to figure out the plan basically all on my own. And so but when I was in my summer before my senior year, I started studying for the LSAT. And the thing about me being younger in college is that I also had to grow up a little bit faster. So I think at this point, I was probably all of 19, I think, the summer before my senior year, because I graduated at 20. So I was 19 years old when I started studying for the LSAT. And as a 19-year-old, you like to enjoy your summers and get some vacation time in and go to the pool and hang out with friends and all that stuff. And so I was trying my hardest to study, but I also really wanted to enjoy my summer. And so I had competing obligations and priorities and all of that. And I ended up going into the fall. I think it was like October of 2022. I took my first LSAT and I wasn't surprised with the score. I wasn't. It was right around what I was testing. Wasn't great by any means. Wasn't even good by any means. But I kind of took that first LSAT already knowing that I would take it again at some point. So it was really just like a test shot. Over the next like 2 years, I would kind of revisit this same cycle of testing, taking it, maybe being a little bit disappointed, and trying to figure out approaches to strengthen areas that I was weak in. And so when I first started studying, I used Blueprint. And the thing I would say to anyone is you can ask any lawyer, you can ask any law student what they did. It almost bears no weight because you will have to spend your own time figuring out what works for you. I talked to some people who were like, oh, I used Kaplan. I got what I needed out of Kaplan. It was great. And I looked up Kaplan one day and I was like, I will not be using the service. there were people who were like, well, just use old tests. Like there's just one kid that I knew. I think he got like 1 point away from a perfect score. It's like a 179. And I was like, oh, what testing service do you use or studying like service do you use? And he was like, oh, I just use old tests. Like I've spent $0 preparing for the LSAT. It was like literally nothing. I just go on the internet, search up old LSATs, and I just study all day taking old tests. And I was like, that's really nice. That I don't know if that's my ministry to use old LSATs to study, which in the end it did actually help me. That was probably the thing that helped me the most. But my issue is that when I was starting at point one, I needed to first learn the test. So there's a difference between needing to learn the test and then learning how to take the test. I didn't realize that. And so I felt like Blueprint really taught how to take the test before what even is the LSAT. It didn't really answer that question for me first.
And so I think Blueprint is fine if you're ready to drop like 1,000 in some change. I think
I just want to interrupt and say that preparing for the LSAT and doing different tutoring services, or as you mentioned, the one company, it costs hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars. And it's just another way that it's definitely a disadvantage for people who are not, who do not come from a wealthy background, who don't have like family to support them in this. I know our family did the best to financially help Tyler, but she also used a lot of her own money from working to help her get the score that she desired.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I thought about that often throughout my journey, because it's not even just the LSAT that you pay for. I mean, you have to pay for services that I've now forgotten because I've worked hard to forget them. But when you take the test, you have to pay for like a score preview. You have to pay to be able to submit the application. So there's an application fee, but then there's a service that you have to pay for in order to submit the application. And these are all like, now, I think the application, the score preview was probably the cheapest thing that you end up having to pay for. I think maybe it's around like $40. Everything else you pay for during your time taking the LSAT is going to be $100 and over. And not to mention the individual application fee. So you have to pay the LSAT fee, right, for the application. But then there are schools out there that are charging $75 for an application fee that you pay on top of the LSAT fee. So you are in the hole as you apply to law school. And the only thing that kept me going is this promise of, you know, high wages once I graduate, which, you know, we'll see what the economy is doing in a couple years. Hopefully that rings true.
Our favorite term is we are pre-rich.
Right. Exactly. And my favorite term right now is, whether they're saying it on the news or not, baby, it's a recession. So tread lightly as you pursue the LSAT process and understand that there is a way to go about it and be super cheap. Like I said, I had one friend who paid zero money to do LSAT prep because he just used resources that he found online, aka Old Test. There's also Khan Academy that's free that has LSAT prep. Once again, $0. But you're still going to pay for those things associated with the LSAC fees, which maybe in total is like $500 once you're all said and done. But then there's the application fee. So it will cost you a lot. And Tariana is absolutely right. Like, I did use a lot of my own money. Once again, I had a very supportive family, but they were supportive in word. In that deed.
Tala didn't mention, but she was quoted in a Wall Street Journal article about how competitive the cycle was for everyone to get into law school. As she mentioned, we are probably headed into a recession. So I think a lot of people have decided that law school is the next best option. Tala, tell me what that was like getting interviewed for that article. And then maybe what is one thing you took away from preparing for the LSAT in this competitive cycle and getting a really good score?
Yeah, so it was a really neat experience to be interviewed for that article. And like I said, one of the things that I hope to do a little bit more in the future is to just kind of reach back and help people who are first generation who are going through this process. The LSAT recently went through a change in its format. It used to have three sections: reading comprehension, logical reasoning, and logic games. And it is now just logical reasoning and reading comprehension. And so part of the reason why I ended up taking a 2-year gap is because I was trying to master this very specific part of the LSAT that ended up being taken away 2 years later. And so I will never forget when I woke up and I read the news that the LSAT had changed. And I was like, wow, this is, we're moving on up. Because one of my best two sections were logical reasoning and reading comprehension. And that's all the test is now. So I was like, this is phenomenal for me. And I echoed this same message in the interview as well. And so I think if I have any takeaways from just like my overall experience
whether it was studying for the LSAT or the actual process of applying. I have a lot, and I haven't really organized all of them, but I'll just spitball a few. I would say when it comes to studying for the LSAT, you have to treat it as a second job. So minus the summer I studied between my junior and senior year of college, once I graduated from college, I was working full-time and studying. And it took some serious discipline to, A, keep my eye on the prize and understand that I wasn't just meant to be, you know, someone working in politics with a bachelor's degree. You can do that and live a very happy life. That just wasn't what I wanted to do. And so it's easy when once you get trapped in the cycle of the 9 to 5, you just want to come home and you want to cook yourself dinner and, you know, watch a good show or a good movie. And then you rinse and repeat the next day.
You have never cooked a meal a day in your life.
No. But or maybe you want to just go pull through the Chick-fil-A line and get a really good chicken sandwich and then go to bed. You just, you know, after a long day, you might want to do that. And particularly for me, in my year working at Treasury, that was an experience that it just had a lot of things going on at the same time. It was the end of the administration, so we were trying to wrap up a lot of things, a lot of loose ends. We were also getting ready for what was the end of my boss's career. There were international trips, and so whenever my team would go abroad, whether it was to China or Brazil, I was working on that time. So I wasn't working on Eastern Standard Time Zone. I was working on, you know, whatever the time zone was, wherever my team was. And so there were times when I was, you know, working and had my laptop out at 4 a.m. my time, because it was, you know, potentially 4 p.m. wherever they were. And so it was the middle of the workday. And so in those moments, once again, I had to keep my eye on the prize and just really understand that you can't lose yourself in the 9 to 5, and that this was a goal, but it wasn't the goal. The goal was to be a lawyer. And so, I would have to come home and I would have to treat it as a second job, and I would come home and eat and, you know, wash the day away. And then I would sit down at my desk. And I would pull out my laptop and pull out a notebook and I would start studying. And the thing about the LSAT is that you don't have to sit and study for 4 to 6 hours. You can study for an hour and a half, for 2 hours, and get that time in for that specific day. And then by the end of a work week, you've had 10 hours of studying. If my math is correct, that's why I'm going to be a lawyer. And so you've gotten 10 hours in of studying for the week. Boom. And then if you want to, you can enjoy your weekend. One of the things that I did, I didn't do this the whole time I was studying, but there were certain periods, maybe it was for 3 months or 4 months, or if I knew I was getting closer to my test and I needed to press a little bit harder, I would take the weekend to do a little bit longer study sessions. So instead of doing a 2-hour session on the weekend, I would do 4 hours. And sometimes that meant waking up really early on the weekend so that I could have my afternoons and evenings open to, you know, do fun activities and hang out with friends and all those things. But the quote that anything you want in life is going to require a little extra effort is so true, that anything you want, you have to put forth the effort to get it. And so wow, I can't particularly say the last 2 years of studying for the LSAT was the most blissful experience of my whole life. I'm obviously happy. And I got basically a 95% scholarship from my school. And that is only because of the hours I lost and the days I lost and maybe having to miss out on some family events and maybe not being able to, you know, go hang out with my friends when they were saying, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to go that, you should come. And I would say, I can't, you know, I really need to get in my studying for the day. It wasn't always the most fun, but it was for a season and it was for a reason. And it ended up paying dividends. So.
Yeah, it really paid off. And I always say to myself that hard work pays off. There have been a few moments in my life I have questioned that. But I think I can say now with 100% assurance that hard work does pay off.
But yeah, and just I never addressed the part about actually applying. My takeaways for that are really think about who's the best advocate for you in a letter of recommendation. There's a difference between asking for a letter of rec because the person's title is really great versus asking for a letter of rec from someone who can really, really speak to who you are as a person, the work that you've done, whether that's in the classroom or whether you've taken a few years off and you've actually worked. And then can also speak to the future of why the skills that you have displayed, whether academically or in your career, will make you an excellent lawyer in the future. There were lots of people where I was considering, you know, having them write letters of recommendation. I was like, I don't know. I don't really know if they are the correct person to speak to my strengths as a worker, as a former student. And so spend time thinking about that. And then I think my final thing is just spend time revising your essays. I was the type of person where I would sit down, I would literally carve out like a whole day to write like my personal statement. I would write it and I'd be like, this is perfect. I ate it up. This is it. This is the personal statement. And then I would spend probably like the next like 2 weeks revising it. But what I didn't realize and only understood this past cycle is that is just your first copy of your personal statement. That is just the first idea you're having. You could have 2 more ideas, 3 more ideas, because it would happen to me. I would write my personal statement. I would be so proud. And then I would wake up one day with like a new idea and I'd be like, oh, but like, I'll save that for, you know, one of the more specific essays. And the thing is that you can stop yourself from feeling like maybe it wasn't your best personal statement or best essay if you just go through the process of revising it and write 2 different versions, write 3 different versions, write 4 different versions, workshop different ideas. And ultimately for me, everybody is so focused on selling a story. And I know that, like, we have had this conversation before, but they often say that, you know, the best application essays are the ones that are like, you know, I grew up, I had nothing, but I want to be a neuroscientist one day. And then, you know, the admissions committee, they throw the papers in the air. They're like, this is the one, full ride, admitted to our school. And that is not everyone's story. Some people are middle class. Some people didn't necessarily struggle for money, but maybe like us, they are first generation law students or first generation PhD students, and maybe didn't have the same access as someone who is richer or comes from, you know, parents who are lawyers and doctors and all those things. And so I think more than anything, I tried to, in the beginning, when I was first workshopping my personal statements, just try really, really hard to manufacture some really great story that just wasn't true to like who I am and my story. And so my final personal statement that I ended up using, submitting, and that ultimately got me into Temple was really just a true story about me, about my life, about my trajectory. I remember I sat down with a coworker at Treasury to start workshopping my personal statement. And I told him my story and I kind of sped through the story. I was like, yeah, I don't really have a special story. I, you know, graduated high school at 16, started working in politics at 17, went to GW, had a really cool internship, worked on the house, didn't love it, went to Treasury. And I kind of just like blew through it. And he goes, I don't think you understand that everything you just said is extremely unique and that there it's possible that no one else in the pile of essays will have the same story that you have. 16-year-old high school graduate starts working in politics at 17. He was like, tell that story. Instead of trying to pull from different chapters and pages of your life that you think will sell better, just tell this story. And I was like, I still think you're wrong. This is not very compelling. But I went home and I just drafted. I literally created the roughest rough draft I've ever created of my whole life, because it's also hard to sometimes like tell your story and feel like it's compelling. Like, because we live our lives and we live every day just trying to get to the next day and, you know, trying to reach our goals, we don't ever reflect on our stories and think, wow, that was really special, or that was something that was really difficult and that took, you know, a lot of effort to get through that. And so when I put my story on paper, I was like, wow. Wow, life is hard. Life is really hard. And I was, and you know, it worked out. And I went back to my colleague and he read it and he was like, this is it. This is the story that the admissions committee is going to really appreciate, not because it is a story from rags to riches, but because it is a sincere story about who you are.
Wow, that was a really good gem. I was just going to add, I think oftentimes we discount our own stories because it's not like what we see in the media. And I think as someone who has worked in media, I want to tell you, they know that, you know, the feel good stories, the ones that are the rags to riches, that's what's going to pull at people's emotions and tug at them. And then that's what's going to get them the most views. I know everyone has seen those viral stories where it's like a teenager was working at a fast food restaurant. They found out like he didn't have money and now he's on his way to Harvard. Like, these are the stories that we see. And so sometimes when you are reflecting on your own life or reflecting on your own journey, you're like, oh, my story doesn't seem like it's special. But it's your story and it matters. And you have no idea how it's going to affect or impact or inspire someone to be like, oh, like I had a similar background to that person, or oh, they overcame that, so I can overcome the challenge that I'm facing. Like, there is power in telling your story, and you just never know how you're going to inspire people.
Word.
Yeah. All right. Well, as we wind down, just like a couple more things I wanted to talk to you about, but I think one of the biggest highlights of your collegiate career, and I'll never forget getting that phone call from you, but you had the opportunity to intern with the office of former President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. What was that like?
That was single-handedly, I think, the top experience of my life. And I'm going to tell a couple stories within this story, but I want to start off with this one. So when I was working at Treasury, I went to a coffee with my boss, and she said,
you keep going. It's important to note that Treasury was after your Obama internship.
It was,
yeah. One of your full-time jobs that you had out of college.
Exactly. So I had just started at Treasury. This was, you know, maybe a month into the job. I go to coffee with my boss. It's just really like a, hey, how's it going so far type of check-in thing. And while we're sitting there, she asks me, she says, what's like the coolest experience in your like short career so far? And I started talking about the Obama internship. And I said something to the effect of, I don't think any other experience will top that. And she kind of like, there was like this disappointment that came over her face. I think one, she was hoping that like Treasury would somehow like outweigh that experience, which it absolutely will go down. Treasury will go down as a top experience in my career. But she was like almost disappointed. And she was like, well, I'm sure that you will experience, you know, many more top experiences in your life. I mean, you know, there's no way that just this internship could, you know, put all your eggs into one basket and you think that's your top experience. And I kind of laughed it off. And I remember later in the day, I was thinking about it. And I was like, no, like, I don't think she understands. Like, I actually don't know, you know, where my career is going to go, what will happen in the future. I am almost 99% sure that the experience I had and the feeling I got of being an intern for the Obamas will almost never be topped at all for the rest of my life. And I say all that because, like, President Obama is single-handedly one of the only, if not the only reason, why I really, really became interested in politics. We talked about, you know, our mom being, you know, active within our local community, but really my top childhood experience that I remember is the 2008 election. And I remember so many things about that. And probably the top two stories that I remember is she took us to the polls. And I remember I was, like, sitting down, and I whipped out my, like, Nintendo because I was, like, the line is really long and I'm bored and this is boring and I'm nowhere near the age to vote. And I was just like, oh, like, I'm hungry too, probably. And so I whip out my Nintendo and I'm probably about to play, like, Mario Kart or Donkey Kong or something. And there's a lady who, like, screams at me from across the gym. Across the polling place, and she's like, no electronics. And of course I'm like a baby, and I'm like, girl, like, I'm not trying to, you know, do anything illegal. I'm trying to play my DS. But she took us to go vote, and I remember her specifically saying, she was like, this is a historic election, we may never see this again in our lifetime, and you need to be here to understand what it was like, to understand the energy, to understand that there's a whole generation of people who fought for this to happen. Yeah, so like Maya Angelou said, there's a whole generation of African Americans who came to these shores, in her words, bowed head and lowered eyes, and who never in their lifetime probably imagined that we would see the first Black president. Because they had no rights, right? They had no dignity. Many of them couldn't even ensure that their kids, you know, would have educations or would have access to opportunity or even just the opportunity to be free human beings, right? That was not even a guarantee for that generation. And so I remember that. But then I also remember the moment he won. And I remember, like, my mom jumping up and down and screaming and, we were watching it in her room, and the TV was, like, mounted on the wall, and I'm looking all the way up at the ceiling because we had high ceilings, so the TV was, like, basically on the top of the ceiling. And just looking up at the TV, there's probably CNN on or MSNBC or something, and just, you know, them panning to the live shots of Chicago, of New York, of D.C., and you see tears in people's eyes. You see that they are shocked that America, maybe for the first time ever, did something right. Like, that was the thing, is that in many people's lifetimes, it's a hard activity for them to point to something that America had done right, to circle it and be like, this was correct. This was a moment that I could be proud of. And that was the first moment for so many generations. I didn't care if you were a 90-year-old. I don't care if you were an 8-year-old. That was a moment that you could circle and pinpoint and be like, we got that right. We got this right. This was overdue. And so, you know, I became, you know, still to this day, you see the aunties walking around with the Obama purses and
Obama shirts still.
Yeah, and it's funny
to the African American Museum wherever they have the photo of the inauguration, and I think it's First Lady Michelle Obama's dress. There used to be a line right in front of that box because people had to stop and take a picture of just the dress and just an inauguration crowd, because it just meant so much to Black Americans to see the first African-American president. I'll never forget hearing about people who said, like, especially elderly people, I can die now because I've seen something I never thought I would see in my life.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the funniest thing that I still see is you'll see brand new cars, like 2024s, 2025s, and they'll have Obama 08 stickers or Obama 2012. And it's just because it meant something to them. And so I say all that to say that when this opportunity was presented to me, I remember being nervous because there's this quote that's like, you should never meet your idols, you know, because what if they don't live up to your standard or what you thought they were? And President Obama in that moment of my life was everything to me when it came to politics. There's probably not even a close second place of someone I considered to be single-handedly responsible for my interests, for my understanding of America, of foreign policy, of domestic policy. I just I would go to Barnes and Noble and I would buy every book I could about the Obamas. I'd watch every documentary about the Obama years. I would, you know, I remember, gosh, you know, one of the moments where I was like, I was really appreciative for who he was and his presidency was after the Emmanuel Amy shooting. And I remember watching the they had broadcasted the funeral live, and that is a speech I go back to at least once a year. At least once a year. Because the same lesson that I said I had learned in what was that, in 2019, working at the Assembly, where I was like, politics is not just about how effective you are in writing policy. It is first and foremost about the compassion that you have in your heart. When you watch that speech, it wasn't a speech about policy, although it could have been. It was a speech given by him that was like, whatever just happened and the way that this person felt bold enough to come into a place of worship, he was like, I understand that this country is broken. And just for the next hour, I'm going to give a speech that displays that I have compassion for these families. And at the end of this, at the end of that speech, he does something that I don't think I've ever seen in my life. He starts singing Amazing Grace. And he leads the first few minutes of it. And then the whole funeral service, the whole church starts singing along. And it's in that moment where you're like, he's not just a politician. He is someone that understands the stakes. He understands where we are as a country. And again, this is right around the time where it was this racial reckoning. And America just could not figure out what to do with this deep-seated hatred that had been brewing for years. And that so many people were weaponizing it because he had amounted to become president. Had he not, I don't know what those years would have been like. Maybe we still would have seen, you know, police shootings, and maybe we still would have seen racially motivated mass shootings. But more than anything, it was a direct symptom of America electing the first Black man. And he understood what he symbolized in this moment in history, and he understood that it was his job to implement the policies so that no one else had to suffer the consequences of a country that wasn't ready to move forward. So, just to fast forward a little bit, the first time I ever saw him walk through the doors of the office, I still feel numb to this day about it. I still can't really, I think also what's so crazy to me is like, sometimes like, it's like the office when you like look at the camera like off in the distance. I felt like it was kind of like that moment, because I still can't believe that like I've met him. Like no one else in my family has met the president or Mrs. Michelle Obama. Like this is a Tyler experience. Like this is me. I'm the only one who can like, it's just like, imagine if I'm like,
you did it.
I know, it's crazy. Cause like, imagine if like, I don't know, it's like, it's crazy. Anyway, as you can see, I'm still geeked about it. But no, he was just like, he is everything you would imagine. And one of my favorite stories, he would walk into the office with his coffee in his hand, and he would say, "Hey, everybody." And it was just like, it was like out of a movie. And I had the chance to sit down and talk with him. And I remember the question I specifically had for him, he took around like 30 minutes to answer the question. And I remember sitting there, and I was trying to be present and be where my feet are and understand that this is a rare opportunity I'm having for the president of the United States to sit there and answer so graciously my question that probably wasn't even a great question. And so I was trying to.
I thought he said that was a really good question.
It was a good question. It was a good question, but it was just the sheer fact that he took like half an hour to just like unpack the little question that I had just asked him. And so I still wake up some days and I have to pinch myself, because I would imagine this is like someone getting to meet like Muhammad Ali or Kobe Bryant, or I don't know, like just the person that they looked up to so much and that is single-handedly responsible for their career. I'm still just so grateful for the experience. It is, I meant it when I said that it is experience that I don't think will ever, ever be topped. And it also has been so powerful in keeping me focused on the goal. When I was talking about, you know, beginning my career in politics and having to come home and set aside time to study and all of that, you can't meet President Obama and lose sight of the goal. You just can't. And so after that experience, I was like, yep, this, I know where I'm going in life. I know where I'm headed. And my only goal is to get there. And I remember, I'm like paraphrasing a little bit because I remember the moment, but I don't necessarily remember the exact words. But one of the other interns had asked him, like, do you have any life advice for like us as graduating seniors and stepping out into this world? And I remember he kind of like looks around the whole room, all of us. It was, how many of us was it? It was six of us. And he goes, I think y'all will be all right. I think you'll be okay. He was like, you're here. You're in this internship. I'm not worried about you all. You'll be okay. And so it's funny because throughout my career and my life, whenever I have like a really, really hard day or a really bad day, and I'm just like, gosh, what am I doing with my life? Will this work out? Will everything I want, you know, happen in the future? And I kind of just remember in that deep baritone and being like, you'll be all right. And I'm like, you know what? If the president thinks I'll be all right one day, then I'll be all right. So it was a tremendous, tremendous experience. And I did meet Michelle too, and she is very, very, very lovely.
Yes. And you also got to attend her book tour, which was also a really cool moment for you as well.
I sure did. I felt like Oprah Winfrey. Like, I was just sitting there. We had floor seats, thanks to the lovely people at our internship, and we got to hear her. It was for her second book. We got to hear her just talk about her life and the lessons she's learned as the first lady. And I don't know, the tickets were probably extremely expensive, and on my own, I don't think I would have ever ended up there. And I remember watching her first book tour, which I think was like pre-pandemic for Becoming.
And I think they made it a documentary on Netflix. So.
They did. And I remember being like, oh, this is so neat, so cool. I will never be able to afford to go to one of her book tours. I really hope she comes out with a second book. Maybe by that time I'll have like a little bit more money. I did not have more money by the second book because I was in college, but ended up being there. I ended up being in the room. And so it made me, just that whole experience of that internship made me realize that I belong. So many people talk about imposter syndrome and walking into a room and not feeling adequate enough, or not understanding or conceiving how their life path could have afforded them to be standing next to, you know, someone who is extremely powerful, or whether that's the president or, you know, the CEO of a company. And after that experience, I don't think I've ever really had imposter syndrome. I don't think I ever will. Because if you put the work in and if you stay focused on your goal, there is no reason why you don't deserve to be in that room and to be with those people. And I don't care the color of your skin. I don't care if you used to stand in food lines as a young child. I don't care if you were extremely rich.
and you had everything you ever wanted in life, there is no reason why you should ever walk into a room and feel like you do not belong. You always belong. You always belong. And like Shirley Chisholm said, sometimes you got to pull up a folding chair. And sometimes, maybe while everybody else is sitting, you may have to be the one standing up. But if you go into that room and you're ready and you're prepared and you know exactly who you are and you know that this is your purpose and exactly where you're supposed to be in life, can't nobody knock you down or turn you around. And so for me, I'm sure that I will have many future experiences in my career, in my life, that will seem daunting. But I don't think for the rest of my life I'll ever question whether or not I'm supposed to be in a room.
Yeah, words to live by. Don't ever doubt that you do not belong in certain rooms or at certain tables or in certain spaces. I think that was something I definitely did when I was a lot younger and talked about in my graduation speech. But I can also say now with 100% confidence that I belong in every room that I'm in because God wanted me to be there.
That's right.
That part. All right. Well, as we wind down, I just wanted to hear your thoughts about political involvement of young people. It's no secret that a lot of young people are no longer as politically active as you are. You are the exception. And I think, as we've mentioned, history is very important, not only to myself as a history PhD student, but it's important to our family. It guides a lot of our principles and who we are today. And I think when we consider the legacy and history of African Americans' involvement in politics, we've always been involved in politics, from going back to the abolition of enslavement. And, you know, sometimes our political involvement has taken on different forms, whether that was actively resisting enslavement with having revolts, or during the Reconstruction period of actually serving in different political offices, even to more modern day civil rights movement that was actively led by young African Americans, such as future Congressman John Lewis and other people that were involved in SNCC, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But I would say after the Obama presidency and kind of over the last few years, we have seen not as many young people find that it's important to be actively involved. So I wanted to know your thoughts. Why do you think it is that so many African Americans, young African Americans, are no longer as politically active as we once were?
I think we've lost sight of why we need to be politically active. I think that if we just pinpoint the 1960s, the reason why that generation, you know, whether they were kids or adults, you talked about SNCC and how there were students literally willing to risk their lives, risk the opportunity to have educations. The reason why they were involved is because they didn't agree with the state of America. They didn't agree. And I feel like there's a current generation of young people who are removing themselves from being politically active because they don't agree with the state of America. Instead of understanding that that is actually the moment that you press the gas and you do get involved. There is something within the law called a dissenting opinion. And it is when you write an opinion whenever you disagree with a ruling. Our existence as African Americans has been a dissenting opinion of America and everything that America is, everything that America stands for. We have been the ones to hold this country accountable, to hold it up to its highest ideals, that if you write these things in a document written many, many years ago, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator, with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you write that, then you must mean that. And there's no way, no way that Gen Z
and whatever generations come before or after, because I stopped paying attention after I know my generation, Gen Z, there's no way that we can think that not being involved is going to end well for us. That means you're giving other people a license to do whatever they want with this country. Push whatever agenda, pass whatever legislation. And I think that more than anything, young people right now are jaded because they have been fighting. If you think back to post-Obama presidency, we think about the Hillary Clinton era. Then we think about the 2020 election, where kids were frustrated with the pandemic and frustrated about the economy and really fired up and ready to go. And there were so many young people who were so excited to vote for the first time for President Biden. And we lost all that steam 4 years later, all of it gone, poof, disappeared. And you have to ask yourself, well, what happened? What happened? And it's that there was a generation of kids and young adults that were fighting for policies that they never felt like were ever implemented. And it's really, really hard to fight for something that you feel like you can't see. And there are generations of kids who have lived through active shooter situations, who have lived through the reality of our current state of policing, and have dealt with the generation of their parents being scared to let them go outside, to let them drive, because everything is built on anxiety. This is an anxious generation. You have to remember that the core of, you know, my generation growing up, right at the end of us kind of transitioning from high school to college, was the pandemic. And so we spent almost 2 years cooped up trying to understand what in the world is happening. It also happened at such a moment that was so important in our lives, in our transition from teenagers to young adults. So many people miss high school graduations and first year in college. And then on top of that, then now that same generation is graduating into one of the worst economies we have seen since 2008. So this generation is gasping for air. They are gasping for air. And there are older generations who are frustrated with Gen Z for being so politically active and then kind of removing their hand. But it's like, you have to understand that they have been through a lot, okay? And they have almost seen no evidence of things getting better. If anything, there's been more evidence that things are getting worse. That is not going to inspire someone to go to the polls or to call 10 friends and drive them to the polls, or to elect new candidates. They're just going to say, you know what, whatever happens, happens, and America has always been the same, and if anything, things are getting worse, and so they do not need me. And I think the Democratic Party has to figure out their identity. I think that they have to find a way to live within reality and not just what they wish the reality was. I think they have to find a way to understand that people care deeply, maybe more than ever, about kitchen table problems, about the things you talk about when you're sitting down with your family at the end of the day. A lot of that has nothing to do with a lot of the Democratic talking points. A lot of it has to do with economic anxiety. How do I afford groceries? Why are eggs this price? Why does gas cost this much? How do I afford to send my little baby that was just born to childcare because I need to go back to work because life is expensive right now? There's a generation like your generation that is trying to figure out when and if they will ever be homeowners and what that looks like, and are jealous of their parents and grandparents who bought houses with the stray cash they found on the ground. And now that they can't even get milk with the stray cash they're finding on the ground. And so there are so many issues that really just have to do with quality of life. And if we don't work hard to really pass legislation and institute policies that improve people's well-being in this country, because not only are we struggling just to get by, but then we got protests going on. We got people getting kidnapped by our own government agencies. Okay. And so we just got a lot going on in this country. And I think while we can be so quick to be disappointed in this younger generation that's coming, we have to remember that they have been through a lot and that they are looking for an answer. And right now they're finding the answer and not being politically involved, or they're finding the answer in a party that is more interested in moving us backward, because they are at least keeping that promise of going backward. And if the Democratic Party can kind of come to its senses, understand that we are not a monolith, that the Black community is not a monolith, the Hispanic community is not a monolith. And so while it's very, very cute to perch people up who you think speak to an entirety of a community, we all have different experiences and we all have grown up in different regions of the U.S. and they have to start learning how to deal with all of our problems collectively. And if they can't do that, then maybe they won't be successful for the next decade.
Yeah, and I think to add on, when I've considered, because this is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, especially when I was working in political journalism, of why this is that so many young African Americans are not involved, I can't help but realize that I think at the center of anything that has come out of the Black community, anything that has been excellent, if anything that we saw with President Obama, is the community, right? There has to be a community aspect to any political movement or involvement that we have in this country. And sadly, we do not have that with Gen Z and these younger generations. I think in the very early history of the United States and African Americans, our community was found in church. Religion was a huge factor. The Black church was everything to these people. And again, I'm not going to discriminate, like whatever religion, whether you were Muslim, those communities were important. So whether you were Christian, you had the Black Christian community, whether you were Muslim, you had the Black Muslim community, but we no longer have a community. We have it online. We have it in social media. You can say, I follow this person, and there can be group chats and all of this stuff. But something we've lost since the pandemic is the in-person aspect of actually touching somebody to be like, how are you doing? How is life? Are you okay? And then being able to hear them share like, no, like I can't afford my groceries. I can't afford rent. I can't afford this. And so we have lost this community aspect of, as you mentioned, you said you went to community meetings. I'm sure everybody in those community meetings are 60 and over. So we need, you know, a community town hall for young people to just come together and be like, yeah, this is what's happening in our community. This is what's affecting me personally, but not to just complain, but to also say, well, what can I do to get involved? I think we've gotten very comfortable going on TikTok, going on Instagram and saying, this is everything wrong with our country. This is everything wrong with our local politics. But my question is always, what are you doing? And did you vote? And if you can't answer yes to one of those questions, you had a role in that. And you're going to have to take some type of responsibility and accountability for your actions as well. So I think kind of just to end this conversation, what advice would you give to someone who, after listening to this podcast, goes, hey, I want to be more politically involved, but to be honest, I don't know where to start. I don't know who I should reach out to. It's very intimidating understanding how bills work, understanding how laws are passed. Like even as someone who covered it for journalism, I had a headache. I was like, this is, don't even get me started about the Capitol Hill process and passing things in Congress. It is so unnecessarily complicated, but what are just some easy steps that people can take to get involved in politics?
Yeah, I think I would say that one of the famous social media quotes right now is, we're losing recipes. And I would go old school, and I would say that it never hurts to read a book, truly. I think we're so fast to, you know, jump on ChatGPT these days and, you know, ask questions. And here's I think you can do a mixture of both. I think you can read a little. I think you can do a couple of Google searches. I think that you can also use ChatGPT. And, you know, there's this thing in math called checking your work, where you, you know, kind of go backwards to make sure that you did everything correct and you got to the answer the correct way. And so I would say use all of these sources that are readily available to all of us, but then check your work. Don't just trust the source because it's out there on the internet or because you were scrolling through Instagram in some pulp culture, little like cute account with really ugly graphics that are like spitting up at you posted something about some bill being passed and it's totally not true. The bill is not passed. The bill didn't even pass the House. We have to learn how to find reputable sources, but also possess the knowledge within ourselves so that when we scroll through Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all and TikTok and all those things, we're able to say, hey, this is, I know for a fact, this is actually not true. And this should be taken down because this is misleading. This is misinformation. And, I would say one of the things to know about how a certain said party is operating in this day and age, they are profiting on people's ignorance. And they are hoping that you don't know anything. They are hoping that you never crack open a book, that you never go and seek out the knowledge for yourself. So that when they get on the TV, when they get on Fox News, when they get on a podcast, when they tweet something out, they are hoping that you take it at face value because you never did the work of enriching yourself with knowledge. And so it is not just my best advice. I'm actually imploring people of every generation because the same way that, you know, 70-year-olds get scammed by the little people who call pretending to be T-Mobile and they're like, send me $1,000 to get your phone unlocked, is the same way that this generation is being scammed with things that are on TikTok and things that are on Instagram. And so we all have to do the work of holding each other accountable. And the last thing I would say, and kind of to the point that we were talking about, well, your point, in that there's always, whenever we were at our strongest as a country, when it came to holding our leaders accountable, it was first rooted in community. But also, if you look back during like the civil rights movement, there was this incredible phenomenon of what people coined the Rainbow Coalition, and how even when it came to the Black community and fighting for Black issues, there were other communities that came in and said, you know what, we understand what it's like to be oppressed. Maybe not in this specific way, but we're here for you and we understand. And I think the same is true in reverse, that we have to start understanding that the way that fascism and the conservative party of the U.S. is working in this day and age is they want to pit us all against each other. And so very recently, I would say since the pandemic, because the pandemic affected each community in very different ways, we've been pit against each other. And we're almost in this like fight toward the bottom of, well, what do you mean? My community is oppressed like this. What do you mean my community is oppressed like this? And, you know, we just got here. And so, you know, we don't have opportunities for these things. But then there's the Black community who's like, well, we've been here and we've been oppressed for years. And I think if we can really, really sit down, look at each other in the face and say that this is not a competition of who is the most oppressed in this country. We are actually all oppressed and they actually don't want any of us to have any rights and to achieve any success. And to amount to anything. And if we can sit down and understand that and start understanding that I am no better than my brother or my sister who is being oppressed, or my brother or my sister who is being deported, or my brother or my sister who is having funds from their higher education institution being taken away because it prioritizes the education of a specific minority group. If we don't understand that they are trying to take us all down at once, and we don't have time to fight about who's the most oppressed, if we can understand that, then I think we're in good shape. And I think that we can start to form what is a modern day rainbow coalition. And that's not just for issues going on in the U.S., but that's for issues going on abroad. We all are much better when we fight for each other. So that's just another way to get involved, is to not just care about what's going on in your community, what's going on in your neighborhood, or, you know, what's going on your side of the fence. Sometimes you got to get on a stool, look over the fence, and see what's happening across the world, across the U.S., in states that maybe you don't live in. And I think there's a chance for us to try to keep pushing this country forward. And, you know, e pluribus unum, out of many, we are one. And I think that rings true.
Well, Tala, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I hope our listeners learn a lot and take away a lot from this podcast, specifically that you can impact your community by just getting involved, and that there's always space and room for you in whatever room or job that you decide to take on. And I just want to say that as your older sister, I'm very proud of you. I am just in awe of you sometimes. You know, we didn't always have the best relationship. I had to learn to let go and let God with you, because you're very strong will. And as an older sister, I was just trying to protect you. But to now see just the young woman that you have become is just so awesome. And the impact that you've made, and the decisions and the good choices that you have made, I'm just beyond proud of you. And I'm so excited for this next chapter of law school. I think it's going to be great. And yeah, we're going to have an Esquire in the family and a doctor.
Yeah, and just to throw it right back at you, any person who has reached any level of success likely had really great people standing behind them. And you have been a source of inspiration, but also someone who I could model my own life and career. And you didn't tell the story. I know we're wrapping up, but you didn't tell the story about how one day Tariana was working in her dream career field, working in journalism. She was at the Senate doing a few live shots, and I was still in college and I was interning at the Senate. And she called me one day and she was like, "Hey, I'm here. I'm downstairs in the rotunda. Where are you?" And I had a break to step away from my internship for a second. And so we came downstairs. We took a picture, I think like right near the rotunda where they do the live shots, where you see all the CNN people and all of that doing their live shots whenever they're at the Capitol. And I know it meant a lot to you. It meant a lot to me, because when you grow up beside somebody and you get to hear all of their dreams and the desires of their heart, to see them living it out is something that is an irreplaceable experience. And to know that we met up in the Capitol working in our respective fields that we had dreamt about since kids, it just goes to show you that life, you know, it can be really kind to you. And so I hope that there's opportunities in the future for us to meet up at our jobs and keep seeing each other dream big. So right back at you, big sister.
All right. Well, that was a beautiful way to end our podcast. As always, follow my Instagram at Life Combos with Tyriana. That's LifeCombos, the letter W, Tyriana, TYRIANA, to just see more clips and behind the scenes of the podcast. But again, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.